This podcast is brought to you by Lannan Foundation and is available at podcast.lannan.org.
Welcome to the Lensic. Welcome, thanks to the Lannan Foundation. I'm Laura Flanders. You must be you. Thank you for coming. We've got an extraordinary treat in store for us this evening. Maud Barlow will be here. Some people have referred to her as the Al Gore of water. I like to think of her as the big wet threat to the lords of water. She's going to get us to focus on one of those topics that's just truly hard to get your head around, partly because you don't want to get your head around it, right? You particularly don't want to get your head around it. 65,000 permanent residents, no aquifer. I'm just saying. I had the experience this morning of coming in by plane from Dallas. I was offered every possible kind of boutique water between that airport and this one. And then I arrive at the wonderful Hotel Santa Fe, where there's a big notice on the wall. In fact, a quite small notice on the wall that says, water emergency. And I noticed that the sign was kind of dusty and framed in wood. Hadn't been tacked up there in a crisis. But it said, you know, don't brush your teeth and don't wash your hair. Don't, whatever you do, flush. And I asked the woman behind the desk, you know, how long has that been there? How long has this crisis, this emergency been on? And she said, well, it's been there as long as I've been here, and I've been here 20 years. Dig a little deeper into the question of our water resources, and it is complicated. USA Today. In fact, I'm going to mention two stories, and I'll bring Maud on. Two stories in today's newspapers. All right. One is USA Today, less drought than ever. Only half a dozen times since the 1800s has this country seen less drought. And there's a great quote from a woman from North Carolina who says, the springs are running rampant with fresh spring water. And I thought, what's a spring running rampant look like? But then you turn to the business pages and the top investor searches of this month, meaning people want to make a buck, they're looking for what to invest in. The searches for stocks that got the most play in the last month were three. Nanotechnology, Homeland Security, and water. Worse, they were in the reverse order. The article that accompanied that story had the headline, Worldwide Fresh Water Crisis Looms. Profit potential abounds. New report. Sure enough, investments in water-related stocks were about $1.5 billion in 2005. They were $20 billion in 2007. This is a growth industry, even as it is a human crisis. Denial is very easy. Reporting in our mainstream media on the environment as a whole has been plummeting. The Columbia University School of Journalism just canceled, suspended last fall, its environmental reporting program. Luckily, there are independent media outlets that are helping to fill the gap. I'd like to think that Grit TV, which you can see on TV, online, on satellite, on cable, at grittv.org, is helping to fill that gap, as are outlets like Grist and others. But we are lucky to have Maud Barlow here. A rampant running stream of information on this issue, maybe. Whether she's at Copenhagen helping to get plastic bottles there banned or protesting dump sites with the Mohawk First people in Canada, she is a leader for global justice. And without water justice, as you'll hear tonight, we can't have global justice. It's not about droughts, she says. It's not even about global warming. It is about global drying. And it's about what Evo Morales said on Grit TV, which was, how are we going to live well together and with our planet? I welcome Maud Barlow. Look forward to her being here.
Wow. Thank you very much. Thank you. Thank you to Laura for an absolutely beautiful introduction. Not that I compare myself in any way, but I once read that after a lovely introduction, Winston Churchill said he could hardly wait to hear what he had to say. I always think good introductions should come after in case people say, well, you weren't that hot. I want to thank the Lannan Foundation very, very much for this wonderful opportunity to be with you and to just tell you that I feel like I'm in heaven. This is the most beautiful auditorium. This is just an absolutely lovely old theater. Thank you to whoever had the good grace to restore this beautiful place. It just gives one hope for our species, does it not? Well, I'm going to just give you a wee bit of background about where I think we are with the global water crisis ecologically and in human terms, talk a little bit about the situation here in the U.S., and then I'll be a little more hopeful because I actually believe that hope is a moral imperative and that we actually want to be thinking in terms of what we can do. And I want to start off by saying this crisis is not something that we cannot deal with. We absolutely have all the tools we have if we do the right things. We need political will. And I kind of see the global water crisis as being about 3 years, maybe 5 years behind the climate change crisis in terms of general consciousness. So this is just part of this odyssey that we're on. Okay, just the first thing to do is to really get into our heads how little the amount of water, their fresh available fresh water there is on Earth. We all learned, almost no matter where we grew up, that you couldn't destroy water because it's part of a hydrologic cycle. There's a finite amount. It goes round and round and round. It can't go anywhere, so you can use all you want because it just goes back and falls back as rain. We all learned that about grade six. Our teachers weren't lying, but they were wrong. And this is a really important thing for us to disengage our heads from. We have to press the delete button on that lesson. If you were to put all the world's water stock into 1 gallon bucket, the amount of available fresh water would be just over half a teaspoon. Or another way of looking at it, I have a PowerPoint that shows the Earth dried up. So that's how big the Earth is on this scale, all brown and dried up. The water we've taken off is beside it, and that's about this big. So the Earth is this big. The water is this big. The amount of available fresh water is a tiny blue dot you can hardly see. So that's what we're dealing with. That's what we have to work with as we have increased our demand exponentially as a human species over the last 100 years, as we urbanize, as we become industrialized, as we globalized, and so everything we make goes around the world using energy and water and so on. And we are, in fact, now in a situation where we are literally running out of water. We know that that by 2030, for instance, a new study by the World Bank tells us that the demand will outstrip supply by at least 40%. And try to imagine what we're talking about here when we say that the demand on Earth will outstrip supply by almost 50%. We're going to be adding another 3 billion people to the planet before that levels off. And I do want to very clearly say it's not population by itself. It's population and lifestyle, because certainly here in North America, we're the worst water wasters. Australia, which has no water left, is the second worst, and Europe the third worst. And the places with the larger populations that are still largely rural are the best in terms of per capita. But as our lifestyle becomes the more common lifestyle around the world, the demand for water exponentially rises. One of my roles recently has been trying to get the issue of water into the climate change talks. It was in Copenhagen trying to do this, working with people at the United Nations on this, because I believe that the analysis around climate change is only half right. Here's the traditional thinking when you come to water. Greenhouse gas emissions are warming the planet, causing climate change and warmth. That global warming is melting ice, snowpacks, evaporating water, and having a dramatic effect on water. All of that's true. What is not understood, however, is another equation, and that is when we remove water from watersheds, and this is what my talk tonight is about, is how we humans have just taken water as something that belonged to us for our use, profit, pleasure and comfort. And we've taken water from where it's needed by nature to where we need it and done whatever we wanted with it. As we remove water from watersheds, from aquifers, and we pump those aquifers like crazy, we've got bore well technology we didn't have 50 years ago. So like places like India have 25 million bore wells going 24/7, pulling that water up from the ground. Ancient water that's been there for centuries and centuries, far faster than any kind of natural replenishment can take place. Up in Lake Michigan, they've got bore wells that go into Lake Michigan that are go as deep into the ground as skyscrapers go into the air. And two summers ago, they were pumping the water. They're supposed to be pumping the water that feeds Lake Michigan. They pumped so hard, they reversed the flow of Lake Michigan and started to actually suck up Lake Michigan water, which is one of the reasons that the Great Lakes are beginning to decline. So when we pull up this ancient water and we take it away from the land, and we remove it, say we send it into great big thirsty cities where we use it and then see it as garbage and we dump it into the ocean if we're anywhere near the ocean. Or we use it to grow crops in the desert, kinds of crops that we shouldn't be doing, and then of course it evaporates. Or, and this is something very important, we use it to produce or grow commodity crops or other products that we then export. It's called virtual water. It's the water used to produce something. And if you export it, you're actually exporting it out of your watershed, right out of the watershed or maybe even out of your country. By this mass movement of water, we're removing water from the soil. And when you have sunlight hitting a soil that does no longer have the water that it had in it, it dries up and it becomes desert. Consequently, or conversely, if you take away the vegetation, the forests and the wetlands and the, you know, all the green stuff that you need for a healthy hydrologic cycle, you also destroy that water because the rains no longer come back. And what I think we all think that there's one large hydrologic cycle. In fact, there are hydrologic cycles over every ecological system, every ecosystem. And if you have dried up or if you've paved over the vegetation there, the vapors move on. And we are creating massive amounts of desert around the world. The Sahara is galloping at the moment. China is creating an area of desert the size of Rhode Island every single year. So the displacement and abuse of water is one of the causes of climate change and global warming, and it is really important that we situate it there. We also know that we're not just experiencing drought, and Laura said this really very clearly. You'll hear the word drought a lot because drought is hopeful. If there's drought, there's end of drought, right? If there's drought, then it's a cyclical thing and rain will come back and it'll be okay. What's really the story is that we're actually pumping the water away to the point where there are parts of the world physically, literally running out of water. Scientists call these hot stains, and they include the Middle East, which is, you know, water is one of the major catalysts of the conflict there. Australia, I've done a great deal of work in Australia. Australia has two water sources, a big aquifer that's being totally drawn down and polluted, and the Murray-Darling River. And they came in, the Europeans came in, and they built their great big industrial agribusiness complexes and started growing rice and cotton and livestock and more recently wine, pulling that with those aquifers and dams, pulling up the water from the Murray-Darling, growing crops and commodities and exporting it out of the country. And now the Murray-Darling no longer reaches the ocean, and in South Australia, the ocean is invading the Murray-Darling and it's dying from the mouth up. And they're simply not sure what to do. I mean, they have done all the wrong things, in my opinion, as have many, many countries, but they continue to think. And if you go into any of the major cities in Australia, you will think you're in a very water-wealthy country. They continue to act and behave as if it's here forever. It is not. Now, China has a lot of water, but China has a lot of people, and China also has a huge export industry. And they decided a number of years ago that they could make more money from a drop of water making it, putting it into industrial production so that all the, you know, shoes and clothes and whatever toys are made there and to ship it out, than to keep it in the ground either for ecosystem protection or to grow food for their people. China is in crisis. India, I said 25 million bore wells going 24/7. Just Google tomorrow or tonight when you go home the water crisis in India. Mumbai, the what used to be called Bombay, they have pumped the water so fast from under that city that they're actually talking about that city going dry. And back to China, I meant to say that they're actually talking about perhaps moving the capital of Beijing. They don't know what to do. Mexico City's sinking on itself. They've pulled every drop of water out under that city. It's now, it's called subsidence, and you'll see the old churches kind of, you know, on the side. And so they're having to go further and further afield for their water. The Mediterranean, the new study from the United Nations on the crisis around the Mediterranean, all of southern Europe, very, very serious. 22 countries in Africa. One in three Africans right now does not have adequate access to clean water. Within a decade, unless something dramatic changes, it will be one in two. That is just an appalling statistic in terms of the of what we know is happening and the deaths that are taking place there. I cannot strongly enough say to you that this is a world that has misunderstood its water sources. We are running out of water. It is a world running out of clean, fresh, available water very, very fast. The human fallout is incredible. We have 3.5 million people dying every year of either lack of access or dirty, just, you know, contaminated water. Every 8 seconds, a child in our world somewhere dies of waterborne disease. It's the biggest killer of children, including malaria, all forms of war, HIV, AIDS put together. And it is, you know, in my opinion, it is the face of climate change, and it's also the face of inequality. It's the most a clear example of a world in which, you know, the most terrible inequality exists when you can, if you have money, no matter how dry a country is, if you have money, you can buy all the water you want for your golf courses and swimming pools and your tourism industry and so on. And there's no money for people to live. And this you know that you're watching your child die, and you would not have to if you had money to get water for that child. And I just tell you just one thing that I just read about, which is just on my mind, is Botswana. Botswana and Yemen, where the so much of the concern exists right now because of the new information about terrorist cells and so on, a lot of that conflict's about water. Yemen's probably going to be the first country in the world to run out. Botswana, they modernized, and the president went to Europe and got all his you know training in modern politics, and he came back and wanted to build a modern Botswana, and then they built a great big dam with World Bank money, and the water's gone. It was like taking, as somebody said, it was like taking a great big frying pan and putting it in the desert and then putting all their water on top of this iron frying pan and saying, what happened to the water? The stories are really very powerful. So as a result, we're now, of course, without surprise, seeing conflict around the world. We're seeing national security issues where countries are saying, I want to look outside my border for supplies the way they used to look for energy, or the way they still do for energy. China is building a great big pipeline to take water from the Tibetan Himalayas that now feeds all the rivers of Asia. So you can see that kind of geopolitical conflict. China and India, knowing they're running out of water, are buying up land in Africa so that they can actually own land and water for future time when they need it. You get the conflict between rural and indigenous peoples and needs versus megacities, as these big thirsty megacities are just taking more and more water. Mexico City has confiscated the water of an indigenous peoples called the Mijaos, and they have taken a pipeline, they built a pipeline, you know, from their source water and put a great big armed fortress around the source water with armed guards and dogs and, you know, and the intent to kill if anyone tries to get in there. Of course, the rich-poor dichotomy, which is very, very closely linked to a struggle that I've been very involved in, and that is who is going to control the world's water. If we had all the water in the world, I wouldn't care if people make money from it, believe me. But when you have a dwindling supply and increasing demand and an inequitable access, the question then becomes, who is making the decisions around water? And there's a very intense struggle out there between those who say that water should just be put on the open market for sale, like running shoes or Coca-Cola, put it out in the market, make it a commodity like oil or Coca-Cola or running shoes or whatever, and that will take care of it. And those of us who say that water isn't like any of those things, you'll die without water, there's no substitute for water, we can't manufacture water, we're running out of it, and it must be equitably shared. And I'll talk a wee bit more about the notion of public trust when I talk about solutions, but this struggle is taking place on a number of fronts. One of them is utilities, those water services, where the World Bank, for instance, will come in and say to a poor country, if you want funding for your water services, we'll give it to you, but we're going to tell you you've got to bring in this private company, and we'll pay. It's not, the private companies don't even invest very much. We'll pay, but then they're going to run it on a for-profit basis. And of course, the story is, if you can't pay for it, you don't get it. I remember standing in a township called Orange Farm in Johannesburg, poverty like you can't imagine, and no running water anywhere, rats in the gutter, and you know, kids with no shoes and burning tires and little hovels. But finally, the miracle within each block of shacks of a pipe and a tap coming to bring fresh water. But between the pipe and the tap is a state-of-the-art water meter. And the only way you can get that water is to get an electronic key, go pay for the water, prepay, it's called prepay water meters, come back and electronically touch it, and then you can turn the key, the tap on, but every single drop is counted, and you're paying for every drop. Somebody there said, you know, we have 80% unemployment here, and it kind of gives due meaning to the old saying, water, water, everywhere but not a drop to drink, right? So people go take their buckets and they walk kilometers or miles to the river that has cholera warning signs on it. So, of course, we've got all these diseases back that we thought we had conquered years ago. We have a bottled water industry that people cavalierly don't think about. Last year in the world, this is astounding, we drank enough bottled water in plastic that if you were to line those bottles of water up front to bottom, top to bottom, they would stretch to the moon and back 65 times. Okay, that's how much plastic we used in the world last year in terms of bottled water. It is the first way to privatize water. I don't want to trust my tap water, so I'll go to bottled water. And you should know that bottled water is not likely safer, and in some cases not as safe. It's certainly not as regulated as your tap water. And there are places in the world where your tap water isn't safe, but this isn't one of them, and we don't need that industry. Then we have water markets. This is a new thing where we actually have water banks and water buying. Australia, although it had water as a public trust in its constitution in 1993, the government gave all the water licenses as water rights to all of those big farming conglomerates. And then they greedily grabbed up the rights, kept pumping out the water, and now there are 80% more rights than water in Australia. In the Murray Darling. Try to be a lawyer trying to figure that one out. Now the government's coming back saying we have to buy that water back from you because we're desperate. We have to save the Murray Darling, and the private companies are saying, well, okay, but we're going to charge you a huge amount of money. And water grabs, Chile is another. Chile is the country that has probably gone the furthest in terms of this water marketing. And Chile now has public auctions, and companies, particularly, I'm embarrassed to say, Canadian mining companies, which are pretty well the worst in the world, come down and they bid against indigenous and local farmers for their water. I'm not talking about water services here, I'm talking about the actual water. So these are the front lines of the struggles that we're having around this issue. So we come to your beautiful country, and here's the situation here. There are 36 states, and this is a very conservative estimate, that expect serious water shortages within 5 years. That's a geological survey study, but they said that six of the worst states, the most desperate states, didn't even answer, so it's really 42 states, which is most of the states in this country. A recent study by the Urban Water Council of 373 American cities found that over half say they will not have adequate supplies to last beyond 20 years. And of course, what we know is that people, and you know this very well, are moving into the areas of the country with the least water. 92% of the country's fastest growing counties are of the fastest growing counties are in the South and the Southwest. The Colorado only has half of the water it had in its recent past and is in what one scientist called catastrophic decline. Of this area, the New York Times has predicted an apocalypse and Armageddon. I mean, this isn't some crazy, conspiracy theorist. This is the New York Times. Although when I hear about conspiracy theories, I think about the two cows on the hill, and one of them's always reading about conspiracy theories, and the other one says, "You and your conspiracy theories." But this time, this cow is reading where beef really comes from. The Ogallala is being mercilessly pumped, is producing only half the food it did 30 years ago. Lake Mead, which was created when the Hoover Dam was built and plugged the Colorado, and at the time was the deepest and the biggest artificial lake in the world, is now in decline and is going to be empty in 12 to 13 years unless something huge takes place. And I think of the Hoover Dam, that whole story, as being a real example of our need to control and conquest water. You know, if you do that, then everything comes from that. In Florida, there are 1,100 people a day moving into that state, and they're pumping their groundwater so fast, big sinkholes are opening up. Don't need to tell you the Southeast, Southwest in crisis, Lake Lanier and in Tennessee River, the Mississippi reservoirs in crisis. The Great Lakes, we're taking a trillion gallons a day, are being pumped out of the lake system, but we're not collectively with nature putting that back. Stephen Chu, who's a Nobel laureate and director of the Lawrence Berkeley National Laboratory, says of the U.S. water situation, and I quote, "There is a 2/3 chance there will be a disaster in this country, and that's the best scenario." Yet election after election in your country and my country and every country, water just doesn't get put on the table, and I want to know why. I think part of it is that lesson we learned back in grade 6, this myth of abundance that it can't run out. We have also built our great wealth on this myth, and we have even haven't even begun to contemplate a future without water. We have seen water as an economic tool for us to use for our own needs and wealth creation, and not as the essential ingredient of a living, breathing ecosystem. So we allow unfettered development, golf courses, swimming pools, mega homes with the mega lawns in the desert. Arizona is, as we speak, building the world's biggest water theme park, and it's going to have waves so big that you can surf, and a river that goes so fast you can white water raft on it. We treat our waterways as a dump site. We dump our toxins and sewage into water as if it's an open sewer. More than half the country's industrial and municipal wastewater facilities exceed the limit of the Clean Water Act. Every year in the U.S., 850 billion gallons of raw sewage is dumped into the waterways here. We also have a very poor way of producing food. And when I say we, by the way, it's the same story in my country. We just have a little more water and a few fewer people, but we're doing our very best to destroy it really quickly. So don't think I'm here telling you that we're doing any better. Industrial agriculture, governments are subsidizing wasteful, chemical-driven, water-intensive food production and using flood irrigation, which is the wrong form of irrigation, to grow inappropriate crops in deserts. Now, this includes ethanol. You need to know it takes 1,700 gallons of water to produce 1 gallon of corn ethanol. And by the way, it's not just here. Brazil, which has lots of water, is going to be facing its own water crisis because they're dramatically increasing their supply of sugarcane ethanol, which is using huge amounts of their water, which will all be slated for export. An astonishing 75% of all irrigated land in the U.S. is in the 17 states where precipitation is not sufficient to sustain crop production. As a result, we're mining groundwater far faster than it can be replenished by nature. Fully half of the water used in the United States every day has come from groundwater, and that's in a very short period of time from when there was very little groundwater used. And every day, and I really want to emphasize this, a third of all the water used in this country is shipped not only out of watersheds, but right out of the country in food commodities. This is called virtual water trade. And mostly it's in the hands of a small number of large corporations, so that money, even the money coming from that, isn't going to communities and small farmers and so on. Then there's the practice of draining watersheds and aquifers to produce water for our growing cities. And as I said, around the world, this applies. It applies here in the United States. We dump the water into waterways, particularly oceans, as waste. We don't capture it and keep it. And then there are so many other issues. There's nuclear reactors, which need billions of cooling water to operate. There's coal and methane gas production, which uses and discards huge amounts of water. Computer chips are very damaging. Computer chip industry to water. The world's mining industry sucks up 200 trillion gallons of water every year. The global clothing industry is a huge water user. Do you know that in 1965... 95% of all the clothing, all the fashion clothing in this country that was worn and sold was made here. Only 5% of the clothing worn and sold here is made in the United States. And so this globalization of stuff and the trade and the movement we know the energy story. We're beginning to understand the energy story behind globalization, but there's a similar water story. And dams. I mean, take the Hoover Dam or take any dam in a dry, arid area, pour water on a desert, which then becomes a saline wasteland, and wonder what happened. I mean, we have 45,000 major dams in the world. Most of them are creating terrible problems. So quite simply, we have assumed that we can undertake any development or industry we want, whenever we want it, and grow whatever we want, wherever we want it, however we want it, and that water will always be available to support that growth. To perpetuate this myth, as I said, we call it drought. But because there's the implication that after drought there will be, you know, rain, there will be water. This is not cyclical drought. I need to say to you, this is the end of water in many parts of the world. Now, what can we do about this? And there's lots to be done. I feel it's really important. I hope is a moral imperative. I think it's really important to talk about what we have to do and what we can do and what is being done. There's lots of wonderful stuff being done, but I also think it's important to have the courage to face the situation that exists, because if we don't do that, thank you. So I have a 3-point plan. I've been trying to get the United Nations interested in. I had the honor last year of serving as the senior advisor on water to President of the General Assembly, Miguel Descato Brockman, who is a wonderful human being, and I'm continuing that work even though his term is over, and working with a number of countries that are interested in seeing if we can get a United Nations emergency resolution to deal with what I just said. Because believe it or not, while there are 24 agencies in the United Nations dealing with water in terms of the on-the-ground programs or the research, there is no political body at the United Nations receiving this information and coordinating anything. The only sort of major institution that looks at water is something called the World Water Council, which is made up of the big water companies and the World Bank, and whose president is the vice president of one of the major French water companies. They don't even try to be subtle. And every 3 years, they have a World Water Forum. And the last one was in Istanbul, Turkey, a year ago this past March, or a year ago now, a year ago this coming month. And so it's every 3 years. The one before that was in Mexico City. The one before that was in Kyoto. And then they come together and they bring, like they had 30,000 people at the one in Istanbul. And they bring governments and everyone in, and it looks for all the world like a big UN summit, but it's not. It's run by the water companies. It's a big trade show. And they take the opportunity to say that everybody agrees that we've made this breakthrough and everyone agrees on this private future for water, and you can see deals being made in the hall with the companies and so on. We're the worm in their apple. I'm the worm in their apple. They hate me. We're there. I remember the very first one back in The Hague at the first of these summits, and they didn't even pretend to even notice civil society. We had to meet in these cold little rooms that we found. At one session, there was a great big, maybe 1,000 people in this room, and all the suits were up at the front, and it was the heads of the big water companies, and the World Bank folks were there, and the big food companies, because they were big into water, of course, too. And we were standing up at mics, and they weren't recognizing us. They were literally skipping over our people. And you could see our people were peasants and small farmers and so on from around the global south. So at one point, I got up, and I went to the mic, and I said, "Mr. Chairman, you have now skipped 8 of our people, and I'm going to co-chair from the audience here, and I'm going to call up our 8 people before you get to take over the chair again." He said, "You can't do that." And I said, "You watch me." So I call my people together, and there's a wonderful trade unionist from South Africa who said afterwards, because we always think of him as being really quite a tough fighter, and he said, "I don't want to do it." Afterwards, he said, "I was more scared of Maud than I was of the World Bank," right? She said, "You get in here and do this," right? In Kyoto, when we went there, we always work with the local communities, and the people in Japan said, "You know, we don't like confrontation. It's just not our political thing. We don't want protests. We want something gentle." So we had to think up different kinds of things. So we went into a huge meeting where Michel Camdesu, who used to be the head of the international the IMF Monetary Fund, was there proposing a new finance plan for the water companies, and we knew what was going to be in it. We knew we were going to disagree with it. So what we did was we designed little lie meters, and they were little sort of half moons with like the color, like fire meters, where it gets really bright if they're more likely to have a fire, with little arrows, and we had little bells on it. So we called it our lie meter. And so we would dingle our lie meter if he told a lie, and we would really dingle it, tinkle it really highly if he... So we scattered, about 300 of us scattered throughout this audience, huge, huge, huge audience, right? So he got up all puffed up and very important and started to give his speech, and the first thing he said that we disagreed with, a couple of tinkles, and there was this silence, and then everybody thought it must have been an accident, and then he gave another one. Well, then he told a whopper, and tinkle, tinkle, tinkle. So Michel Camdesu, this very important man, says, "I hear you're tinkling. I am not intimidated." It's, you love taking these guys on. This is apropos of nothing, but recently I took a tour over Canada's tar sands, which if you want to talk about, I'd love to talk about. They're horrible, awful, terrible, terrible. We've taken down a boreal forest the size of Greece to produce this oil from this bitumen. It's just very, very terrible. Terrible, terrible, holding tanks of poison water. Everything up there is dead. Absolutely everything. There are cancer clusters, bile duct cancer clusters in small children in the First Nations communities. It's a terrible, terrible thing. Anyway, I took a tour and took a flyover and then in a helicopter. And so on, held a press conference in Edmonton, and I called it Canada's Mordor from the Lord of the Rings, right? One of the energy CEOs came back, and I thought, oh dear, this was a bad answer on his part. He said, "It's not as bad as Mordor." Well, if you know Lord of the Rings, Mordor is the death of everything, right? It's the death of nature. It's the death of humanity. It's the death of everything good and the human spirit. And okay, so it's half as bad as the death of everything. I think we should talk, right? So it's, anyway, so that's the cows on the hill and the, where beef really comes from. So here's what we need. We need to take this water story away from the World Water Council and the big water companies, and we need to make it We need to bring it down, right down from our local communities through our state and national governments to a concerted plan to deal with the world's water crisis. And here are the three kind of general principles that I think need to guide such a process. The first is we have to respect water where it is. Nature put water, or God, depending on your belief system, put water where it belongs. We've got to stop playing with it. We've got to stop removing it. We've got to conserve water. We have to restore water. We have to maintain and preserve watersheds. It is the single most important thing we can do. Withdrawals must not exceed discharge. We have to harvest the rainwater. We have to catch the stormwater. I was in South Australia, which I also took a helicopter tour over. There are two cities, and they're both in desperate crisis because the water that they were using from the Murray-Darling stopped flowing, right? There's Adelaide and Salisbury, and they've taken two different approaches. Adelaide's taken what I call the hard approach, which is technology. So they're building desalination plants. We're extremely expensive, very energy intensive, and pour out a terrible poisonous brine back into the ocean, costing a fortune. The overruns are already just astronomical. Right next door in Salisbury, this brilliant guy, Colin Pittman, his name is, I met him. He's an engineer. He convinced City Council 10 years ago to let him experiment with water capture and storage. So it's rainwater, sewage water, and dividing sewage from toxic water and stormwater capture. And then putting it through a series of some recycling through, you know, the traditional technological recycling, but mostly through the ground, mostly through building kind of canals and wetlands and so on. And he's greening the desert. He's got so much water, because they sell it now, that he can actually sell this water to other cities. And Adelaide refuses to, you know, they're just like, okay, I see the miracle, but we've already put all this money into this technology, so we can't move away from it. We need absolutely strict laws on pollution. I have to say that I can't think of anything, any crime worse than poisoning water that other people need for life and livelihood. Martin Luther King said, legislation may not change the heart, but it will restrict the heartless, which I love. We have to end the notion of the right to capture. We have to take this back. We have to redirect subsidies to sustainable, local, non-chemical food production. This means we're going to have to challenge this virtual water export, and this is going to be take a very brave political person or persons to crack that, but it's going to have to happen. We're going to have to keep water home locally. This means we're going to have to confront the biofuel craze. We need investment, infrastructure investment. We have leaky pipes and dirty pipes that need to be, our public water system needs to be reinvested in, and we need to reject bottled water. Mostly, we need to confront the notion of growth. We need this notion that more, and we can still have everything we want, which I have to tell you is my critique of cap and trade. It's a way of saying, well, we don't have to challenge growth or the unlimited power of the markets or these international trade agreements. We can just have a market on pollution, and we'll just make money from that as well. And I feel it's the wrong model in every conceivable way, and I'm telling you it's the wrong model in terms of water. We are running out of absolutely everything. We cannot continue this. An American environmentalist said that unlimited growth has the same DNA as the cancer cell. It has to turn on its host in order to survive. And that's what we're turning on our earth, the host, to survive. We do not govern water. Water governs us. We may not like the fact that there is a rule of water, but we now have no choice. We have to stop mobilizing water to our needs and our expanding needs and organize our societies, our behavior around the rules of nature. This is going to be very hard for us to do, but we're going to have to do it. And we're going to look to certain groups of people who know how to do that, rural communities, peasant communities, indigenous communities, the Acequia system here and other places where people know how to treat the land and each other in a way that's equitable, fair, just, and as stewards of this land. It's going to take very, very courageous thinking, but water's going to force us to do it. I'm convinced of it. So that's the first principle. The second is this notion of water as being our common heritage, which does not mean a free-for-all. Let me be very clear. I think we need tough rules around water. Just because it's a common heritage does not mean we, you or I, get to do something bad to it because you can't stop me or I can take more than my share. That's not what I'm talking about. And we need to say that water is a public trust and a human right. The notion that certain natural resources, especially air, fresh water, and oceans, are central to our very existence is this notion of the public trust. And it says, therefore, governments must exercise their fiduciary duty to sustain the essence of these resources for the long-term use and enjoyment of the entire population, not just the elite and the wealthy and the privileged. U.S. courts have been increasingly using the public trust doctrine, and I quote, as a high, solemn, and perpetual duty from one of the court decisions. And the doctrine is well entrenched now here, and I think it's something we need to be exploring more. A wonderful man named Jim Olson is doing very exciting work in Michigan on this. He's been fighting bottled water on the notion of public trust. And we're even beginning to move the notion of water as a public trust to a kind of law that says, well, it's not just the equitable access to this, but the actual water has rights. And I've been exploring this. I'm very excited about this. It's been termed wild law. And wild law is the next stage where we say, okay, do the commons themselves need protection? A South African environmental lawyer, his name is Cormac Cullinan, has coined the term wild law, and he refers to the need for a body of law to regulate human behavior in order to protect the integrity of the earth and all species on it. He says, as members of the earth community, our rights must be balanced against those of plants, animals, and ecosystems. In wild law, a suit could be brought against in a situation in the name of an aspect of nature, and humans would be prohibited from deliberately destroying the functioning of ecosystems or driving other species to extinction. Cullinan points out the irony of the, and I would point out the irony of the legal court decision, Supreme Court decision here, upholding the notion that corporations are legal entities when whole species are not considered to be that in our world. Wild law was the inspiration behind a 2006 ordinance in Pennsylvania where a community recognized natural ecosystems and nature, natural communities to be legal persons for the purpose of stopping the dumping of sewage sludge. Very interesting. And Ecuador, to my knowledge, has become the first country in the world to introduce the notion of wild law to protect its waters. So I really think this concept is something very exciting. And on the human right to water, we're working very hard both at the United Nations because it was left out of that first Declaration of Human Rights back in 1948 because nobody could conceive of this issue at the time. But we're also working with communities and countries. 4 years ago, Uruguay became the first country where they had a plebiscite, which led to a referendum on their ballot, on their national election, which led to a constitutional amendment that not only is water a human right, but a public service, has to be delivered on a not-for-profit basis. The last concept, the last principle really excites me as well, and it's the whole notion of environmental cooperation, but even further than that, the whole notion of environmental peacemaking. And this is the notion that if you have an environmental crisis, that rather than fighting over that issue, whatever that thing is that you're fighting over beyond across political borders, that you will find ways to create a shared regional interest towards building an ecological community, internalize shared norms, and reduce the possibility of violence. And I am telling you, there is violence. Just read about a story of a village in India where the groundwater's gone and they have small pools of collection and this family went out to take some early in the morning, and they were killed by other members of the community because that is considered shared water. I mean, it is going, we're going to see more and more of this kind of conflict around the world. And this is based on the notion that environmental issues cross borders and ignore political boundaries. So it's about equitable access, fair allocation, the shared management of disputed resources and cooperation in areas of conflict. But further than that, there's a lovely notion of environmental peacemaking, and this is where a shared resource can be used as the first point of agreement where the war maybe has happened or violence or conflict over something else. And that's where you seek to you trust building and vision sharing. You create maybe the collective identity around that, shared knowledge about this common asset to create a long-term dialogue. It helps prevent conflict, acts as a lifeline during conflict, and can lead to government-to-government solutions. And this is the notion here is that you're not going to fix everything else, but if you can find a way to share this one area, you can find a way then to find peace. In other words, water becomes nature's gift to humanity to teach us how to live with one another in dignity and more lightly on the earth. I think of those comet movies, you know, that where the comet's coming to earth and it's going to hit, and in 72 hours the whole world will blow up. So all of a sudden it really, all your religious differences and everything else suddenly don't matter. So they send Tom Cruise or somebody up there to blow it up. I was thinking, take the kid, take the wife. well, we do have a comet coming at the earth. It is the global water crisis, and it could be something, and it could be not a conflict if we could start to see it in a profoundly different way. And my example is a wonderful group called Friends of the Earth Middle East, who are people from all of the warring communities in the Palestinian territories and Israel and Lebanon and Syria and so on. And they've come together and they just talk about water, and they continue to meet all through the conflicts of the last few years, including the most recent last year. And they have come to a place where they've actually taken down a piece of the wall, because they have learned, you know, you're a human being. Our kids play together now. They've brought in a whole youth movement, a whole youth group, and they've built the kind of trust just over water to bring down a piece of that wall. And there's a lovely picture of 9 mayors from warring communities holding hands, jumping into the Jordan River, because save the Jordan River, you save ourselves. And that's the road to peace. We're going to have a lovely conversation with wonderful Laura, but I just want to end this with my 2 favorite quotes, because I just love these and I find them hopeful. The first is from your own wonderful Carl Sagan, the late wonderful environmental scientist, who said this. He said, "Anything else you are interested in is not going to happen if you cannot breathe the air and drink the water. Don't sit this one out. Do something. You are, by accident of fate, alive at an absolutely critical moment in the history of our planet," which I think is gorgeous. And the other is from Tolkien. I kind of got Tolkien on the brain. I loved this before the films, but I did love the films. But this is Gandalf. It's the night when the massive army of evil is amassed to maybe destroy everything good and living. And if you remember, the whole notion of this evil is the death of nature. That's why the trees rebelled, and it's about killing good is killing nature. So he's talking about being a steward, and I think I'm in a room full of stewards tonight, so I just want to share his thoughts with you on this. He says, this is Gandalf saying this, he says, "The rule of no realm is mine, but all worthy things that are in peril as the world now stands, those are my care. And for my part, I shall not wholly fail in my task if anything passes through this night that can still grow fair or bear fruit and flower again in the days to come. For I too am a steward. Did you not know?" Thank you so much.
Thank you.
That concludes the reading for this event. Up next is the conversation.
I want to remind you all there'll be a book signing afterwards. So if you want to get your hands on Maud's books, they'll both, I think, both, Blue Gold and Blue Covenant?
I think so.
Will be available in the back. You reminded me of another quote, as you ended with quotes, from my dear, much missed June Jordan. We have choices and capitulation is only one of them. I like that quote. Listening to you, Native peoples often tell us there's a spiritual component to our treatment of this planet. Mm-hmm. Is there a spiritual component to our disdain for water or the way we use it and abuse it?
That's a lovely first question, and I believe truly that we do, and I'm guilty as charged until I entered the world of water, got water on the brain. We've disassociated ourselves so much particularly in the first world, in the global north. Anything that we run out of, technology will fix, you know. So in our country, we had the largest collapse of a fishery in the world with the cod fishery collapsing. There were so many cod once off the coast of Newfoundland that they say that the fishermen used to be able to go out and walk on them on water when they were spawning. And there are no photos because it was before it was, but there's paintings of that. And they're gone. So we thought, well, everybody, okay, well, let's just take the Chilean sea bass. Oop, they're gone. Well, what's under them? There's another fish underneath. And there's just this notion that it's endless. For me, on a very personal level, when I set out on this journey, and it was all political at first, it was about the politics of water, it soon became about something else. And that was taught to me by people in communities around the world, usually indigenous communities small farmers, local peasant farmers and so on. I can remember being in one community in Bolivia where all the water that this family had was in a little jug, really, for that day. They only came in twice a week. A truck would come. Sometimes they could afford to buy it. Sometimes they couldn't. And yet when I left, she gave me some water. And this was their gift, all she had to give me to thank me for what we're trying to do with them. So I set out on a journey to understand every ancient people, every indigenous community, historically all of our religions are all grounded in a respect for water. Mm. And angry water gods, we have a great mythology from the Inuit of the North that when you murder or when you do something terrible, that the vengeful goddess is a water goddess who will come and pull you down, because she water has great power, and we've lost our respect for water, and we've lost our respect for its place in nature, and we just simply have to get it back. That's what offends me mostly about bottled water, is in containing it in plastic, which is fossil fuels and chemicals, and I think it hurts water to do that. And it actually does, by the way. They have a wonderful Canadian scientist, Bill Schottick, who's doing work in Germany. And he has done work on what happens when you allow plastic bottled water to heat up. Say you leave it in your car. You buy it in a carton or whatever. You leave it in your car. It heats up. You take it home. You put it in the fridge. You should not be drinking it because there's a chemical release that you should not be drinking. And I've often wondered about the Iraq, you know, the Gulf syndrome they talk about. And I've been told by soldiers that they drink, the water comes in, it's left sitting around in the heat, and then they take it in and put it in, they cool it off, and I just wonder if it's not poisoning them. The disdain and the notion that it has no value for itself has been lost.
What changed between the period of the writing of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights and today, such that there's at least beginning, thanks in part to you, to be a consciousness that there wasn't then?
Well, just that at the time, we didn't have the bore wells. We didn't have modern technology. We didn't have globalization, not very much. Stuff didn't move around the world. We weren't destroying the world's water tables. Now, that doesn't to say that there weren't polluted rivers in cities. Back in London, England, you read, historically, they would pour all their garbage in the river. So it's not to say that we didn't pollute water, but it could clean itself up as soon as we stop polluting it. What's new is the destruction, the overpumping. It's the massive movement of water. If you look at dams, pipelines, the deep bore well pumping, and flood irrigation, that's all recent. Yeah. That's all the last 40, 50 years. We've only had the technology to pull this water up and away from where it belongs in the last 40, 50 years. So there was no consciousness. There was no need for such a right to water concept at the time. In the last few years, it's really been gaining as it's been very clear that these private companies are coming in, taking over water rights, particularly in the global south. And the demand for the right to water has come from local indigenous communities themselves. I don't mean just indigenous, but like local, where they're saying this, you know, I don't have access, I don't have a right to water. Just one little example, not even from the global south. In the Mediterranean, a typical tourist will use 4 times the amount of water of local people every single day. There's always this kind of special treatment of wealthy people, foreign people, tourists, and so on. There's just a priority given to water. And I had this is very moving, and again, back in Bolivia in the early water war back in Cochabamba. I said, how come water? Why are you, you know, why did you take up arms for water? Because they came and took your minerals. And, you know, they, because the miners there, the story of mining in Bolivia is terrible. A lot of companies came in and took over transit and energy and everything else. And he said to me, because I'd rather die of a bullet, or I'd rather see my child killed than watch my child die of dirty water. So it's the demand for the right to water has really grown very quickly as this massive dichotomy between those who can afford water and those who cannot has surfaced.
Does everybody know, or do most of the people know, about the story of the charmingly named Cochabambinos? Talk a little bit about the fight against Bechtel.
Well, this is one of the first world water wars in the world. There have been several, many since, but this was the World Bank used to give company, or used to give poor countries 20 years ago a choice between funding for a public system or a private system, but increasingly it turned to just private. We're just going to give you money as a condition of getting this money. It's called conditionality. And in this place in Bolivia, which is landlocked and the Andes are melting, and let me tell you, this is the people from the Andes community Copenhagen were so passionate about the, you know, what global warming's doing and the fact that there's going to be mass movement. People aren't going to be able to live there. And it's a largely indigenous community, about 75 to 80%. They brought in so the World Bank said, if you want money, you have to bring this company. And they picked Bechtel, which is a big engineering company, and knows nothing about water delivery. Bechtel set up a water distribution company and immediately not only tripled the price of water, but they said, we're going to charge you for the water you gather in the cisterns on your roof. Because they said, all the water here, even the rainwater, belongs to us. And the people said, no, it doesn't. And the movement was led by a 4'7" shoemaker named Oscar Oliveira, who took to the streets, and they had such a revolution. The army was brought in, and a 17-year-old boy was killed, and a lot of people were badly hurt. Bechtel was forced to leave. And interestingly, Bechtel, yes.
Yeah, come on. Bechtel was forced to leave.
Bechtel used, and you should know that trade agreements are very much part of this, because there are 2,600 bilateral trade agreements in the world now. And most of them have the right, this is called investor state right, where a corporation has the right to sue a country if what the conditions that they met when they first set up business there are changed. Say you find out there's a product this foreign company is making has poison in it, or is a carcinogen of some kind. You didn't know that when they came here. Now you know that. And you say to them, you've got to stop dumping that in the water. They can actually sue for compensation for lost future revenue. So there wasn't the bilateral between the United States and Bolivia. So they set up a subsidiary in a European country that had a bilateral agreement and sued Bolivia for millions and millions of dollars. But it was so unpopular for the company, and we created such a fuss that they settled for a dollar. So, and then Evo Morales, and the same thing that La Paz, the capital of Bolivia, also went private to Suez. And they put up a great big plant under this mountain called Mount Illimani, which is a snowmelt, which provided water for all the local communities. They just took a pipe and piped it down into the city and sold it to people who could afford it, cut off the local people. And so when Evo Morales, the new president not so new now, came to power, one of the first things he did was just tell Suez to go the way of Bechtel. And this is happening in communities right across the global south. They're just telling these companies to get out. Now, the problem is, very often, the governments don't have the money to install decent programs, healthcare, education, water services, whatever. And our argument is, if the World Bank has enough money to give these private corporations the money to do this, they have enough money to help with the knowledge transfer and so on. And even if it has to be an arm's length situation or agency of some kind, if the state isn't able to perform that, but it needs to be non-profit. What you need to understand is, when a private company comes in, even if they invest in it, once their investment is paid back, they are still making money for years and years and years on something that should be a fundamental human right. And they just will not deliver to people who cannot afford it. And if you think it's just in the global south, a few years ago in Detroit, they cut off the water to 42,000 families, mostly African American, who couldn't afford the water bills. So, you know, this notion that it couldn't happen here isn't true. It's going to happen in communities here as well.
You mentioned Copenhagen briefly. Can you just explain for us a little bit more the way that you are looking at climate change in relation to water? Because it's really noteworthy, and it's not the conventional view.
It's not the conventional view. But when I talk to people, when people hear the story, the light begins to go on, and we're beginning to make some serious inroads. I'm working with some scientists in Slovakia, and this is kind of how the process in my head started. And they did a study in their country of all the paving over and the creation of new industry and urban development. And they discovered that for every percentage of urban growth, there was a decrease in the rain over that area. And they made the direct correlation between the removal of water and vegetation from the soil, because you've paved over, to the disbursement of the clouds, the vapors. Because if there's nothing to fall on, when it does rain, it's just like hitting a great big cement umbrella. And eventually it leads to the ocean. And these scientists that I'm working with actually think that the rising oceans are as much caused by our dumping of water into the oceans from all these different systems as from global warming. It's a combination, the melting glaciers and so on. But think of it as humans are putting a great big straw into the aquifers and streams and lakes of our continents. I'm not talking about water that runs into the ocean. I'm talking about interior water. We suck it up. We create huge industrial food production systems in deserts, and of course it just evaporates away, or we send it into huge cities and they just dump it, many times of course untreated, but untreated or treated, the water is still going that way and not going back. We don't even capture the stormwater. And as I say, the virtual water trade is this other way in which we capture that water and then it's gone forever. And what we don't understand is that ancient fossil water that's under the ground is not being replenished. And when it's gone, it's gone. You combine that with pollution of surface water and people physically, literally don't have an alternative. So what we're trying to do, it's not to introduce a peripheral, because there's a little bit of a critique if you try to add this and that and the other thing. People wanting to talk forest, food production, I think it's all relevant. The amount of cattle, we know that cattle are responsible for about 18% of greenhouse gas emissions or of methane gas emissions. So there are lots of things that aren't peripheral. One of my critiques of the process has been that it has been totally driven by the story of greenhouse gas emissions. And then so you get the scientists and the environmentalists coming together to talk about this percentage and that percentage, and everything else gets forgotten. I call it climate change made me do it, you know. So I don't have to deal with anything else. And I'll give you the perfect example. The perfect example is Australia. Not the current government so much. They're not doing anything better, but they at least don't say these stupid things. But the last government, the Rudd government, the Howard government, actually said We've done nothing wrong with our water. It's climate change only, and it blew in from away. None of it was here. They're a major coal producer. They produce huge amounts of greenhouse gas. They're the most urbanized country on Earth. They're producing tons of greenhouse gas emissions. They're engaged in flood irrigation. They're engaged in huge mining operations. They are polluting their water. They are destroying their water. And he blames, winds blowing in from somewhere else.
Did we make any progress at Copenhagen? I mean, we did. You did ban bottled water. That was good.
Yes, yeah.
But we got more coverage, really, of a few hacked emails than we did of what happened.
I'll tell you what happened. The bad thing that happened is that your wonderful president and others kind of hijacked the UN process, and that really has to be said. There is a United Nations process, and it is frustrating, and it takes a long time. Democracy's messy, and it doesn't move fast, but there are working committees that were, I would say, 70% there in coming to an agreement, and they might not have come to it in Copenhagen, but they would have come to it by the next COP16. Flew in the big leaders, didn't look at any of the work that was being done. They had a non-meeting. This is all UN jargon, right? And they came up with a non-text. That means it wasn't official, and that turned into the Copenhagen Declaration. And all sorts of countries are just furious about it because they felt it was left out. And here's the fear, is that it's going to move from a multilateral process now to one driven by, well, each country will all be Boy Scouts and each country will do its best. My country, Canada, will do its worst, I promise you. We need an international agreement to put pressure on my country because of the tar sands and the United States and the worst polluters. So that was not a good situation, and I think people need to know that. As one of the leaders from the Global South said to a group of us a few days ago in Washington, you folks from the North have to be a little more humble in these talks and be a little more supportive of the Global South. That's the bad. The good thing that happened in Copenhagen is that a whole new movement came together. And this is called the Climate Justice Movement. And this is different than the strict environmental, the more traditional, older environmental groups that are, dancing on the head of the pin about, 2.5, 1.5. These are people who said, and our motto was, change the system, not the climate. And this is an understanding that the global climate is a symptom, as is the water crisis, of bad global politics, of a market system, unregulated market system, gone crazy. What I call savage capitalism. And it was very, very exciting to see. And there were a lot of young people. There were lots of poor people, indigenous people, lots of people from the global south. And the very clear understanding was that we have dumped our, we had a picnic and we dumped our garbage in the global south and we kind of like them to clean it up. And people said no. And to me, this movement was kind of the movement that came out of Seattle 10 years ago, kind of reborn.
Is there a conflict between markets and competition, wild capitalism or just capitalism, and conservation? I mean, if companies are making money selling water, why should we conserve it?
Yeah, the issue for both the energy answer, cap and trade, which is again this commercial financial answer to find ways to make money from a crisis, the same thing's happening in water. And that is, well, just the headline that you read, Laura, about, it's a terrible water crisis. You'll see this often on these websites, and they'll go on and on. They'll quote the UN, they'll quote people like me, and then they'll say, now, boy, is there money to be made from this, right? It is incompatible to say that I will make money and I will be in a growth situation in that industry and conserve water. It's not possible. If you are a global competitor, you have to be ruthless. You have to externalize your costs. Dirty water is a good thing if you're in business, because somebody's got to pay to clean it up. Not enough water, more people chasing water than water exists is great, because you can pull the price of water up. It's simply not compatible. Privatizing water will, and promoting that ownership, private ownership model of water will lead to more of a free-for-all on nature than we already have. It will mean that the rich will get water. It will go to those who can afford it, not to those who cannot. But also it will discourage us from policies to conserve, because it's not in the best interest of General Electric's gone into the water business, of the Suez, of the Veolias, of the Coca-Colas. It's not in their interest to have policies to say you can't have access to this water.
Kind of like prisons. Why would you ever need to help somebody get out of prison if you're making money off it? All right, so moving to, we haven't got a whole lot more time, but moving to solutions. I'm sure a lot of people have seen the reports from Haiti since the earthquake. And the image that sticks in so many of our minds is the image that a lot of reporters brought back of devastation on the one hand and huge pallets of thousands of bottles of water for American soldiers, mostly, on the other hand. We had a guy on our show yesterday, a Haitian-American architect who has a plan for a memorial in Haiti that would involve planting trees in this horribly deforested place for the dead and lost. Mm-hmm. What's your advice for a country like that? What's the solution to the kind of deforestation? If you get a chance to build new now, what do you do?
Well, it's those principles, I guess, that I articulated earlier, and that is we have to rebuild around nature and around nature's priorities. I mean, Koch was right in there right away saying, you know, we'll pump and produce more water. In a temporary situation, of course, you're going to have water pipe brought in of some kind, but to, you know, to use it to cement, and I worry that this happens in situations like that, to cement a private future for water and everything else, by the way. I mean, look what happened in Iraq, the private schools, the private medical services, the whole privatization of a collapsed state. Well, then there's an opportunity to rebuild from a private perspective. So I would say that the principles that I articulated, not just for water, but for rebuilding Haiti, need to be followed. But a profound change to a democratic future for Haiti. I mean, we know the story of the occupation of Haiti and how Haiti and so many other places have been used so terribly in it. And our countries, our governments have promoted the kinds of leadership in those countries that have helped our big businesses and helped our foreign policy and geopolitical positioning. While the people suffered, and it's an appalling situation. It can't, it's got to be seen as more than just a place for charity, for us to feel sad, and really we must look at the model in Haiti as being the end result of doing all the wrong things, and moving to with dignity and respect, change the situation there. There are no easy answers to some places. I'm not going to suggest there are. There's no easy answers to a place like Yemen, which has just built. They've got no water left, like 5 to 10 years of groundwater. They have no other source but groundwater, and they're planting these cut trees. You know, it's a narcotic that people chew and that just drinks up the rest of the water. There are no easy answers in countries like Darfur or in cities, communities like that. I don't want to sit here and say I know the answers, but I think that if we can adopt some fundamental principles of local control, local democracy, and respect, and that we're coming to build justice, not charity, with that model, I think we can start the rebuilding of in a different way than we certainly have acted in many communities in the past.
Do we have an opportunity? Yes. You mentioned the Hoover Dam built in the Depression era. Do we have an opportunity at a time in the U.S. when people are talking about stimulus money and the president today is marking the, I think, 1 year of the stimulus package? Is this a sort of change that one could make maybe state by state with a bit of federal fund help? What can we be organizing around to be like the Uruguayans, perhaps?
Well, the scientists that I'm working with in Slovakia are talking, a wonderful man named Michael Kravsik is talking, we're very excited about the concept of building green rings around all of our cities, that we literally could put millions of people to work rebuilding our watersheds. It's going to mean decommissioning dams, many dams around the world. I'm not saying all the dams right away, but our love affair with dams has got to go. I mean, the story in Botswana is so awful. I mean, they built this awful, this huge dam with World Bank money. And the World Bank, as Peter Glick says, knows how to spend $1 billion in one place, but doesn't know how to spend $1,000 in a million places, when often that's, it's a well, or it's a system, or it's a, you know, something else that's needed. Something much more, respectful and technologically, useful for the community that needs it. It's like putting a great big giant frying pan in the desert. The water's gone. I mean, they have destroyed their water table. Between that and De Beers, which the diamond company, which has got access to the water in the Kalahari, which is why the Bushmen have all been pulled out. When you look at a situation like that, you say, you know, if you didn't need to destroy it in the first place, and you've got to undo it, we've got to learn from these situations. So I would like to see this money, the stimulus money, being used to rebuild nature, to put people back to work rebuilding a green economy in this country. And I have to say, it's not just alternative green technology. I think we need to be really careful thinking that some new technology is going to save the day. There is a place for all of the technologies that we're talking about, but I'm really worried about, I just saw a study that really disturbed me, and it's from Germany, which has done the most in the world of any country to convert to feed-in tariffs and wind operations and solar and so on, and their greenhouse gas emissions are still going up, yeah. Like everybody else's. If we still have the global economy, if we still have massive trade, and the fact what I told you earlier about all your clothes and this, all our clothes made in North America come from other parts of the world. As long as we have this notion of unlimited growth, export-oriented commodity products and policies, the conditionalities within the global south that say you have to let our corporations come in and continue to do this, we're not going to find the solutions that we need to the ecological crisis. The ecological crisis and the system of governance, the notion of unlimited, unregulated, never-ending growth in markets has got to stop. We have to return. I'm not talking about undoing markets. There are good markets. There are markets that work. But the control of our economy by the large corporate interests has got to end. The economy needs to serve people and communities, not the other way around. We can build very, very different kinds of communities, very different kind of economic system based on our respect for one another and for the beautiful earth that we've been given.
I think that's a beautiful note to end on. Thank you.
Maud Barlow, everybody. I just wanted to remind you her books, Blue Covenant and Blue Gold, will be for sale, and she'll, I think, sign them in the back if you're very lucky.
And
thanks for coming out.
Just a last little piece of advice from a 95-year-old friend of mine. When anybody starts getting tired of social or environmental activism, she's been an activist. She fought for everything from women's rights to labor rights to you name it. She's been there. And she says, oh, you young people. And she says, by that she means anybody under 90, right? Everybody loves her. She says, you think that just, you know, you're fighting for social justice is a fashion that you can do now and then. It's not. And she gets all whipped up, and she'll say, it's a commitment you take on. You do it every day. And then she gets really mad. She says, ooh, she says, fighting for justice, well, it's like taking a bath. You do it every day or you stink.
Thank you. You've been listening to a Lannan podcast. You can subscribe to our podcasts at podcast.lannan.org. In addition, the Lannan Audio Archives present similar programs by national and international writers, poets, and social activists at www.lannan.org. Listen to hundreds of hours of recorded programs from the likes of Seamus Heaney, Joy Harjo, Eduardo Galeano, Arundhati Roy, Jim Harrison, Edwidge Danticat, and Noam Chomsky. New programs are added every month to both the podcasts and the audio archives.